Welcome to an encore production of the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Raymeyer. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, Making a Match on the Web, and we're talking about money, not marriage.
I really was intrigued by Grace's request for a loan because she wanted to increase production in her peanut butter business, and it just really captured my imagination, and I loaned her $50.
Also, a Bedouin woman in Israel defies tradition to study for her PhD. And an American visited Honduras and found out that soccer may be a universal language, but it does have different dialects.
When you're playing soccer on a sandbar, the dugout canoe is not out of bounds. Oh, and the ball is playable in the river.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. What would you do with an extra $50? You could use it to fill your gas tank, or you could lend it to someone in the developing world. If you did that, you'd be part of the micro-lending revolution that's changing lives in poor countries around the globe. One organization, called Kiva, is making the process personal and easy. Potential lenders can go onto Kiva's website and choose a small-time entrepreneur to support. They can lend anything from $25 to $200. Then they get regular updates on how the business is doing. Within months, the lenders are paid back without interest, and they can choose to withdraw their money or invest it in someone else. Tom Hutchinson is a contractor in Virginia. He decided to lend money to a woman named Grace Ayah in Uganda.
I really was intrigued by Grace's request for a loan because she wanted to increase production in her peanut butter business. And it just really captured my imagination. And I thought of, and I could see a picture of Grace. And she had a very well laid out business plan with how much she was going to need for these different items for business, a new grinder and a refrigerator. And it sounded like a very interesting business venture. And she was asking for $475. I couldn't start any business in this country with $475.
Now, did you give her $475?
No, a lot of other people had already loaned some money to her. I loaned her $50.
Tell us about repayment. Did you get paid back and how long did that take?
Well, it wasn't too long after I made the initial investment that I received an email from Kiva saying that the loan had been raised, all the money had been raised, and that it was dispersed to Grace. And then periodically, every month, I would receive an email saying that Grace has made a payment in such and such amount. And one thing I was quite impressed with is that Grace said that she would need 6 to 12 months to repay the loan, and she paid it off in 5, as I recall.
I mean, I don't want to be crass here, but a lot of people give loans for interest. They make money off of giving loans. Why did you take the time to invest $50 in someone you'd never met in Uganda?
Well, that's a good question. The answer really is because I'm an entrepreneur myself. I have my own business. I have some employees. And I know how important it is for me to have access to capital. And so the thought that I could actually help someone in a similar venture, another entrepreneur, with just $50 out of my pocket is just amazing. And to see that she's been successful, I get regular updates and have seen that she's paid off the loan and her business has gone quite well from what I understand. So to be part of that, that's all the reward I really need.
Hey, would you like to meet Grace, Tom?
I would love to.
Well, I've got Grace on the line from Uganda. Grace, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Hello, Grace. Say hello to Tom.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Very good, Grace. It's so nice to talk to you.
It's really nice for me, too.
Grace, tell us a little bit about what you did with that money that Tom Hutchinson sent you.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having really contributed a lot to my improvement on the business that I had. I bought a fridge, which really improved a lot on my business. Here in Uganda, we are having a lot of power crisis, whereby sometimes 2-3 days, you don't have any power at all. Up in the freezer, I put up always all the peanuts that I make in excess, and I keep them up. At least that takes about 2 days without getting bad, and then have a lot of it so that I can distribute it to the customers in time that they need them. Part of the money, though, I used for buying packaging materials. That is the containers that I would pack in the peanut butter when they're ready for distribution.
Overall, what has this done for your business? How have profits gone for you?
I must say, I am almost 30% more than I used to get at the beginning.
30% more. And have you hired anybody to help you?
Yeah, I have now two people whom I'm hiring, and they're really doing a great job. In fact, I'm so proud that I've created jobs.
Oh, that is wonderful. Now, we're talking to you from Uganda, and I've heard some children in the background. Can you tell us where you're standing and who I'm hearing in the background?
Okay, I'm just standing right in front of my door, and all these are my children, that is the ones who are making noise at the background.
They're all your children?
Oh, not all, though. Oh, the elder ones have already, part of them have gone back to school. Others are doing shopping for going back to school. They are all in boarding schools.
Did you say there were also some orphans there you were taking care of?
Yeah, right now I have almost six of them.
Are they your family members?
Not necessarily. Some of them I just picked during the war. You know, I come from the northern Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
And I really was caught up in this war. There was lots and lots of killings, and some of these, some were my friends, some I just knew the parents, others I didn't know at all, but because I found them suffering, the parents would be killed and they had nowhere to be, I picked them up.
So you have a business there, and you have six orphans there living with you, as well as your own children that you support?
Yes, they're all living with me. During the holidays, when the elder children come back from the boarding school, we are almost 15 in the house.
Do they all eat your peanut butter?
They do. But that I've made a point that at least every morning they need to take the breakfast when there is peanut butter.
Tom, is there anything you would like to say to Grace?
Well, I've said this many times. I feel, Grace, so lucky that I was the person who happened to see your loan, that I could have been a small part of this. And to hear your story is very stirring, and it's exactly why I'm involved in this sort of adventure with Kiva, because I really believe that a little bit of money can make a big difference in someone's life, and I'm so proud to be a very small part of yours and of your success.
Grace, anything else you would like to say to Tom?
Yeah, I would like to send my most heartfelt gratitude, Tom, that you really helped a lot. I really feel that part of what I got from you people has helped me got more money, and I'm able at least, because last year two of the children had to stay home. They didn't have enough school fees. I managed towards the end of the year when I was already producing more with that loan that I got. I managed to put them back to school at least, and I'm sure this year I'll be able to put them back to school, all of them.
You said that you have to pay school fees to get these children in school, and two of them you haven't been able to afford, but now because of your business, you're sending all of the children to school? Is that right?
Yeah, I feel very hopeful, because come Monday, that's when I'm really going to be very sure that everybody is going to go to school.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
What a treat. It was wonderful to talk to you, Grace, and good luck with the school year. And Tom, I'm glad that we got to be the conduit through which you two met by phone.
Yes, I'm so glad. And Grace, it was so nice to talk to you, and hopefully someday I'll see you in person.
Nice to have talked to you too, Tom.
Tom Hutchinson spoke to us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Grace Ayah spoke to us from a cell phone just outside Kampala, the capital of Uganda. For more information on Kiva, go to our website at worldvisionreport.org.
When you are done today, Jemma walked on today.
In my dreams, I hope and pray, I must go back there someday.
Israel's Negev Desert is home to more than 150,000 Bedouin Arabs. They're nomads who have lived in the region for centuries. But over the last 50 years, most Bedouins inside Israel have started to settle down. They've swapped life on the move for a more modern existence. But traditional practices die hard. And in this community, which is one of Israel's poorest, girls are often denied access to education. Shia Levitt brings us this portrait of one Bedouin woman who's breaking the mold.
It's a typical night in the Abu Qaf household. Rambunctious three-year-old twins climb on the furniture. Around 9 p.m., they finally run out of steam. Mom, Sarah Abu Qaf, dressed in a pink sweatshirt, long black skirt, and a purple headscarf, puts her boys to bed. Now she can focus on preparing an evening meal. She mixes cumin, pepper, and flour into ground beef, while her daughters cut potatoes for French fries. 2 years ago, her home did not have a gas stove or even running water. There is still no regular electricity, no paved roads or public transportation in this Bedouin village. Abu Qaf loves her close-knit community, but she says living here can also be difficult.
To wash clothes, sometimes I don't have any water and I can't wash dishes. You feel that all the life, it's around a basic needs and how to survive this.
Abu Qaf has her hands full raising five kids, but she's decided to take on another challenge. She's getting a PhD in clinical psychology, and she's the first Bedouin in Israel to do so. The process has not been easy, though. As an undergraduate, Abu Qaf regularly studied for exams by candlelight.
I put the candle. It's very close to me. And I read what I have to read. And many years I do that.
During Abu Qaf's childhood, most Bedouin families did not have money to send their kids to college. The few who did manage to get a higher education were usually boys. They were seen as a better investment since they stay in the family while girls marry and move outside the family. But Abu Qaf says she had unusual parents.
In the past, I think my family was very different because they take care of us. They all the time encourage us in the elementary school, in the high school. They give us all the things that we need for education.
Abu Qaf's hard work paid off. She got a full scholarship to attend Ben-Gurion University, where the majority of students are Jewish. Abu Qaf was grateful for the opportunity, but felt isolated. Her experience led to her PhD research. She's focusing on helping Bedouin students cope with depression and emotional distress. Right now, there are no Bedouin clinical psychologists with whom these young people can speak.
This is a big problem, which will affect badly the treatment. In our society, there is no person that doing these things. I want to close this gap.
Abu Qaf says it's not only a language barrier that prevents Bedouin people from getting counseling.
There are some elements that in the Bedouin culture that it's difficult to ask for help. You feel shame about yourself when you need another person to help you. Maybe you show to the others your weakness. And I think maybe when I'm doing research about that, I will suggest some alternatives that they don't feel very distressed about taking help or from another people.
Today, Abu Qaf is visiting her sisters-in-law, who live in houses just a couple minutes from her own. In a large tent outside the house, the women sit around a small fire pit on mats and carpets on top of the dirt floor. They snack on fruit and drink tea. One of the women, named Basma, says she grew up just a short walk from her local school, but she never attended a single class there. Today, all her boys and all her girls go to school. She says she's happy her kids will have more opportunities than she did, and she hopes this will bring them a better life. Abu Qaf hopes the same for her own children. Back at home, she listens to her 10-year-old daughter, Mays, read a book written in both Arabic and English.
Please find out about the first day of school in other
today,
countries.
I think that my girls see many role models. We very surely convinced that they will go to high education, to advanced degrees.
So far, Mays wants to be a nurse when she gets older, and Sarah Abu Qaf and her husband hope to do everything they can to help all their children achieve their goals. For the World Vision Report, I'm Shia Levitt in Umm Batin, Israel.
Mrs. Brown is our teacher.
Coming up, we'll hear about an unusual game of soccer in the rainforest. But first, Earlier in the show, we spoke to people who had used Kiva, an organization that helps poor people around the world get loans to start a business. That's the type of work Carol Chilios was doing. But when she visited the West African country of Mali, she saw firsthand the thousands of beggars on the street, and she knew they needed more than just a loan. So Carol and an African friend decided to start a school for girls. They took 10 girls and gave them each a living stipend. They hired local women to teach the girls how to bead, sew, and dye fabric, skills that Chilios hoped would enable the girls to start their own businesses when they finished school. At the end of the first year, they held an open house.
Those girls were transformed in 1 year. The girls who walked into the center on the first day with their head down and their shoulders slumped were standing proudly next to a product. And I remember Kadia walked over to a necklace and held it up and said, looked at it and pointed at the necklace and pointed at herself and grinned with a big grin on her face and sort of held her hands out as if to say, these hands are now making things instead of begging. It was a beautiful moment.
How do they change over their time in this program? What do you see happening? Can you tell us through the life of one girl, one story that maybe would typify what the girls go through?
One of the students who stands out is Fatoumata Kone. She is about 19. She led a very challenging life. She was raped as a young girl, gave birth to a stillborn child. She tried to work in a household, was beaten, finally ran away from the household and ended up on the streets. And we found her living on the streets and begging. Let's just say that she had a lively character. If someone looked at her cross-eyed, she would beat them up. She would pull hair. She would scream and rant and rave. And when we first, I happened to be on that recruiting trip and we were on the streets and we wondered if she'd make it. Well, after 6 months, when I walked back into that center, she was a transformed young woman. Here's an example of her transformation. At the open house, we had the students do the talking, and there were about 150 government officials, NGOs. So they're all in the courtyard of our little school, and Fatoumata is explaining the curriculum. And she stands up when she's finished the curriculum, and she looks out over the audience, and she says, "Let me ask you all a question. There's a lot of you out there. What do you think a young girl who's begging on the streets wants the most?" And nobody answers, and she pauses. And I'm like fearful, okay, what is she going to say? And she pauses. She says, "Well, I'll tell you if you don't have the answer." She said, "We want love. That's what we want. And we're pretty hard to love because we're street kids." She said, "We're like the African soil. If you leave the African soil and you don't put water on it and give it nourishment, it dries and it cracks in the form that it is." She said, "But when you put water on the African soil and you mold it and you continue to add water, you can create beautiful things." And that's what we get, is the love that helps us form and shape ourselves. Well, needless to say, there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
The school is now into its second year, and though things are going well, they're still only reaching a few dozen girls in a sea of beggars. I asked Carol Chilios about that.
It isn't about the numbers. It's about doing one small thing that can have an impact in that way. Would we like this to be replicated? You bet. We think we have a great model. We've already been asked to replicate it. But for the moment, you know, we're two women doing this as volunteers. We're using what limited resources we have, and we have 10 girls. We're about to recruit 20 more, and it's one girl at a time. And really, just imagine if every person did one small thing, then we would have the numbers. But for us, it's not about the numbers. It's about doing what we can within our own capacities.
Carol Chilios is the director of the Fabric of Life Foundation. She spoke with us from Seattle. Studies say up to a quarter of all Mexican children may be malnourished. Inevitably, the worst hit areas are also the poorest. But a group of women in Veracruz State is finding you don't have to be rich to eat well. Conrad Fox has the story from the village of La Quinta.
45 women pack into a wooden shack that serves as the local health clinic here. At a wood stove in the front of the room, several women are gathered around a huge pot of rice. Some are chopping vegetables or making sauces. Others are tending the fire. Sandra Ramos stirs the rice as she explains what's on the menu today.
We're making white rice with vegetables, and we're also preparing green mole sauce. We're going to show the other women how to cook with plants they can grow in their own gardens, so we can make something nutritious for our kids.
And that's the point of this once-a-month gathering, to keep kids healthy. The women swap recipes that go easy on the wallet, but are heavy on nutrition. Volunteers, Ramos is one of them, bring recipes and ingredients from their backyards. And the other women watch how they prepare the food. The meetings usually coincide with a visit by doctors and nurses who perform health checks and give lectures. It's all part of a federal government initiative to improve nutrition among poor women and their children. Studies show that malnutrition in Mexico is most pervasive where poverty is greatest. That's no surprise, but many experts say its underlying cause often has as much to do with attitudes and customs as with economics. Eduardo Villanueva, a government doctor, frequently gives talks to the women's cooking groups.
Como mexicanos, somos hechos de maíz.
As Mexicans, we're made of corn, beans, and chilies. If you look at what people are eating, it's usually no more than tortillas with salt, or bean broth, and lots of chili. The local custom is to eat lots of grease, fry all their food. It's a diet high in carbohydrates, and low in vitamins and protein.
And modern junk food can now be added to that diet. Even in poor communities, it's not uncommon for a family to go through at least one big bottle of Coke in a day. Birsa Chalamigua sits at the back of the health clinic, watching the food being prepared. She says junk food has made many of her neighbors lazy when it comes to their kids' diets, sometimes with tragic results.
They give them anything, chips, puddings, or just beans with no vegetables. I've seen malnourished kids. They're skinny, underweight, pale. Some even have their hair falling out.
Her 5-year-old son is healthy, thanks, she says, in large part to these nutrition classes, which have taught her how to make vegetables palatable to kids. Gudelia Cano is the coordinator of these classes. She says that since they began 13 years ago, the incidence of malnutrition has significantly dropped here.
In this community of 46 kids under 5 years old, we've just got 3 children who are underweight, and that's just slight malnutrition.
Pretty soon, the food's ready, and it's kids and journalists first. We sit around a table with plates piled high. The kids seem to have learnt their nutrition lessons as well as their mothers. They tell me it's important to eat vegetables every day. And they even know why. And what are vitamins, I ask?
Medicina.
10-year-old Silvia says they're medicine, so you don't get sick. And when I asked the most important question, did you like your food? Here was the response. Even if you didn't know what that meant, you just have to look at their plates to find out. Every one of them is empty. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in La Quinta, Mexico.
If you want to get to the Honduran village of Mocorón, you have to take a bumpy 3-hour ride on a dirt road from the country's Mosquito Coast. The villagers in Mocorón live in wooden houses on stilts spread along a river in the middle of a rainforest. Freelance writer Kelsey Timmerman and his brother Kyle recently visited Mocorón. They brought soccer balls for the kids there and found themselves in the middle of an unusual game.
When you're playing soccer on a sandbar, the dugout canoe is not out of bounds. Oh, and the ball is playable in the river. Soccer is a universal language, but when I played the game in Mocorón, there were some rules that took some getting used to. With a flick of his foot, a boy of about 11 sends a soccer ball ricocheting off the bow of a boat. It heads to his 9-year-old teammate standing in front of my goal. The kid fakes right. I fall for it. He shoots left. The ball rolls between the goal markers, two piles of curly wood shavings from a recently carved canoe. Goal. The kid struts by me to give his teammate a high five. He barely comes past my waist. Word of our game has spread among the kids at the village, and our numbers swell. At one point, my brother Kyle is surrounded by 5 of them. 10 little brown bare feet whack at the ball. I can't decide what he's trying harder to do, kick the ball or not squash anyone. Kyle and I grew up playing soccer in a small league in Ohio. We wore shin guards, had matching uniforms, and were treated to little plastic barrels of sugary fruit drinks, whether we won or lost. The kids in Mocaron, on the other hand, wear shirts given to them by relief organizations. One shirt says, Benton High School, class of 95. Another has a dancing Snoopy on it. None of them know who Snoopy is. As for refreshments, the kids drink the river water by the handful. There aren't even any soccer balls here. Kids play with anything that is semi-round and kickable. In this land of hunger and malaria, the shiny new soccer balls that we brought are a luxurious treat. The game continues, but the sun and the humidity are ruthless. Then, in mid-play, without a signal or a word, every kid, player and spectator alike, runs into the river. Kyle and I are left on the makeshift field, scratching our heads, wondering, who called the timeout? The second time this happens, we follow. Eventually, we learn the rule. If at any point in time a player is hot and feels a need to plunge into the river, he or she may do so, regardless of the score. All are required to follow. The third break, Kyle leads the way. Tonight it will start raining and won't stop for 12 hours. By tomorrow morning, the sandbar that is our field will be lost beneath the swollen river. The wood shavings that marked our goals will be drifting to the Caribbean Sea. Our simple soccer field will be washed away. Our soccer balls won't last long either. The sandbar does not lack for sharp rocks and is hard on bare feet. It's also hard on $25 soccer balls. Ours goes flat. We brought the balls all the way from Ohio with the hope that the kids of Mocaron will be playing with them for months to come. Every guest hopes their gift outlasts their stay. The backup ball goes flat. Everybody, into the river.
Kelsey Timmerman is a freelance writer and columnist based in Greenville, Ohio. Thanks for listening to this week's Encore production of the World Vision Report, and please join us again next week. Remember, you can hear us anytime on the web at worldvisionreport.org. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.